Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
That becomes, see, I really believe this. I believe that we need, and we don't have right now, in some of the eco-pedagogues who are involved in eco-pedagogy, environmental pedagogy, they're helping us do this. They're helping us create this template that will enable us to say, okay, I believe that there is an alternative to vampire capitalism. And it's, you can't have any kind of sustained reform within the capitalist law of value. It's just not going to happen. You know, you can redistribute some of the wealth here and there, and it's like putting, you know, a Band-Aid on a, you know, mortal wound. It's going to help a little bit. It's going to stem, you know, the pain for a short period of time. But I think we really need to uproot capitalism. And the reason that I think people are reluctant to do it is because there's no real viable alternative. And there has to be that viable alternative in the minds of the people before they just, you know, can jump out and take to the street.
That's the voice of Dr. Peter McLaren. On this week's show, we speak to Peter McLaren about education and social change in the academy and in the streets. So stay tuned.
Someone who has written extensively on the importance not just of revolution and liberation, but of reflective praxis in education is my next guest, Dr. Peter McLaren. We're very privileged to have you on our program. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
We think about Labor Day. For me, it's impossible to not connect Labor Day to the multiple struggles of workers throughout the world. And since I'm, you know, Latin America defines my context of reference, I think back of the multiple uprisings of peasants, uprisings of workers and factories, and the continued struggle to be recognized. Why are these stories of resistance denied a presence in the academy?
Well, in the academy especially, these stories are meant to be silenced. And they're meant to be silenced not necessarily by direct ways, but by indirect ways. I did a book this year called Academic Repression with Steve Best, Anthony Nocella, and Richard Kahn, in which we actually share the stories of a number of academics on the progressive left and the radical left who have been systematically, either removed from the university or roundly punished for their political work outside of the university. I think it was Paul Goodman who made the statement that in the United States you can do anything as long as it doesn't make a difference. I think that those of us in the academy that have attempted to take our work outside and join up with social movements, revolutionary social movements, movements with indigenous workers and factory workers around the world have found that our work has been marginalized and in some cases demonized. So that's pretty much par for the course for universities. It's rare that educators who take on this work actually survive within the academy. It's a bit of a juggling motion. But I just give you one example. I was in the town of Chirán in Michoacán. And in that community, which is mostly Purépecha, the Purépecha peoples, they're attempting to in effect, break away from the state and create their own autonomous government. And they have now a citizen militia, and they're patrolling against the illegal logging that's occurring on their lands around Chiang. And there have been some violent clashes between the loggers and the townspeople, which have resulted in deaths. And unfortunately, the narco traffickers have sided, of course, with the loggers because they get a take in the logging. So basically, it's the townspeople versus, you know, the narcos, and that's a pretty powerful struggle that's occurring. And I think that it's the kind of struggle that those of us who care about community, who care about young people, who care about social justice, that we need to either get involved in it directly or at least connect with those kinds of struggles, write about them, and let the rest of the world, and especially the educational community, know what's going on. And it, work like this is not the kind of work that's necessarily condoned by universities, and because for reasons I think that most of your listeners would know.
You know, it's interesting that while you point out that most people realize there's something wrong, when we have a system based on blind obedience to authority, and in many ways, I think that it's healthy to have resistance and to have a sense of agency in the acts, in the way we interact with society, in the way we participate as well. So how do we remember the struggles? You know, because amnesia has become mandatory. You know, we just, something happened, we right. forget, we put it on the back of our minds and we just let it there.
Right.
So how do we remember to remember those struggles, and what victories should we celebrate that will enliven the spirit of resistance?
I think there's a difference between remembering and memory, but they are connected at some level. I remember growing up, as I was born in 1948, but the first socialist government of North America, and one that was really influential at the time, was in Saskatchewan in 1944. And it was called the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, of course, of Tommy Douglas. And they won an overwhelming victory. They took out the Liberal regime, which, you know, had pretty much dominated politics in Saskatchewan since the province was formed in, I think it was around 1905. And Douglas and the CCF, they went on to win, you know, five electoral victories. We can owe our, when I say our, I'm speaking for Canadians here, we owe our universal health care to Tommy Douglas and the CCF. They created Canada's first public automobile insurance agency. They created a number of crown corporations, government, public-owned businesses, and many of those still exist today in Saskatchewan. So they also allowed the unionization of the public service and, again, created, you know, the first system of universal health care in Canada. And, you know, this all kind of set the grounds for the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, as well as the previous Canadian Bill of Rights. So we can look back, for instance, to Saskatchewan in 1944. But there's also all kinds of other strikes that I think have been key that we need to remember. And we need to bring these these struggles into our classrooms and discuss them with our students. And, of course, I could just mention a few. Of course, we have the really important Great Southwest Railroad strike, and I'm speaking here about in the U.S. context. You know, that involved 200,000 strikers, And we had the great Pullman strike, which involved about 250,000 strikers. That was in Chicago, Illinois. We know about the great anthracite coal strike. That occurred in eastern Pennsylvania. There was about 147,000 strikers in that struggle. The steel strike of 1919, and of course, I'm referring to Pittsburgh here. We have the textile workers' strike in 1934. That involved nearly 500,000 strikers and the entire eastern seaboard. We got the bituminous coal strike. That occurred in 1946. That had about 400,000 strikers involved in that across 26 states in the U.S. We had the steel strike in 1959. Again, about 500,000 strikers. That was a nationwide strike here in the U.S. And more recently, we had the U.S. postal strike in 1970, which involved about 220 strikers. Lasted a couple of weeks, started in New York City, but of course spread throughout the country. And then, of course, the most recent, I guess I would identify, would be 1997, which would be the UPS, United Postal Workers strike, which involved close to 200,000 strikers, and which was led by about 185,000 UPS Teamsters. So we've got pivotal strikes that most of our students in our high schools and even in junior college and college are really not aware of them. And you know, Labor Day is a day I think we should highlight those strikes, highlight the struggles of working peoples, highlight struggles that are directly involved with the struggle between labor and capital, and use these strikes as a means of opening up discussions about current day capitalism, how it works, how it exploits, how it constitutively exploits human beings in terms, you know, relationships between people into relationships between things. And then, of course, do what I think every good educator should do, is try to dream up alternatives to the labor, to value production under capitalism. How can we create successful socialist alternatives to capitalism? And we could start by, you know, discussing some of the attempts that are occurring today. We could discuss some of the strengths and limitations of Cuba, for instance. That's pretty well historically documented. But also, most recently, in Venezuela, one of the co-ministers or vice ministers of education just contacted me 2 days ago, asking me to come to Caracas to give some talks in February. And I've always appreciated the opportunity to be invited to go and speak in Venezuela, where, of course, the Bolivarian Revolution is in full swing. And, you know, I don't go there simply as a committed Chavista. Of course I'm a Chavista. But I go there, you know, to listen to some of the complaints and to listen to some of the criticisms by workers and by students. The Bolivarian University, which was used to be the headquarters of one of the major, you know, oil executives, the executive offices for a major oil company, was given over to the students. And so we actually sit and have seminars in the rooms that were dominated years ago by the oil executives. And some of the students in that university are quite pleased with some of the strides that have been made to create a truly Latin American socialist university, but also they've had some criticisms too. So I'm there not simply to, give the Bolivarian party line, but I'm there to listen to the criticisms, and I'm there to listen to some of the complaints and the voices of those that are struggling to make the Bolivarian Revolution a reality.
I'm so glad you point that out, because I think that a resistance or in a price in a revolution of any kind that lacks reflection is one that is doomed to repeat some of the things that we abhor. Talk to us about how should we conceive of this moment, because whether we look at communism, not communism, but communism community, as a viable form of organizing our society, or whether we call it socialism for the 21st century, what kinds of ideas are to be reflected upon and perhaps given serious consideration, you know, given the problems we face, you know, the current problems we face with increasing inequality, with exacerbated violence against peoples who are already marginalized by poverty and social exclusion. Can you talk about this?
I mean, I work within what's called a Marxist humanist trajectory, and that Marxist humanist trajectory is a platform that I find does address some of these issues. The question that we ask is the question you just asked, Sylvia, and that is why, if I could just rephrase it slightly, why do so many revolutions with good intentions turn out to be their opposite? And a lot of it has to do with, I'm getting a little philosophical here because I'm very much a Marxist Hegelian. Basically, revolutions stop at the first negation, and Marx taught us to struggle for the negation of the negation. And let me give you an example of that. I was asked a few years ago to visit some of the recuperated factories in Argentina, and I was in Buenos Aires, and I was visiting one particular occupied factory, or another term would be recuperated factory, where the workers said, look, we're not leaving. The capitalists are trying to shut us down, but we're going to stay in the factory, and we're going to sleep in the factory, and we're going to keep production going. And so they made some arrangements to turn themselves into a cooperative, and they got government cooperation to do this. And they asked me to go and speak there because there are about 200 of these factories, and they were starting to think about creating schools inside the factories. And, of course, they wanted to use some of my ideas and those of Henri Giroux and Paulo Freire and many other people whose shoulders I certainly stand on. And so they said, well, we've gotten rid of the capitalists, so this is really, you know, socialism. And I said, well, not according to Marx. You've gotten rid of the capitalists, but you haven't gotten rid of capital as a social relation. They're still producing goods under the capitalist law of value. So that, you know, Peter Hudis, who's one of the Marxist humanists that I was mentioning, he's come out with this incredible book called Marx's Concept of the Alternative to Capitalism. And he's really gone through and looked at Marx's writings, not what people have said about Marx, not what former communist regimes have said Marx said, but he's gone through all of Marx's works and began to formulate, because Marx was very vague about what the alternative to capitalism should look like. He was vague, but there are hints all the way through his writings. And for Hudis, you know, when labor is determined by necessity, or when external expediency ends, that is, when we exist outside of value production, that is, Sylvia, outside of wage labor, when we're no longer defined by material production, and that when we attempt to survive this vampire capitalism, but we're no longer measured by labor time, then and only then are we able to take our first real steps to freedom. So that this is basically Marx's perspective. And we can hear it, obviously, in his phrase, from each according to their abilities, to each according to their needs. And that's a very important, I think, observation. Marx was not saying that needs are met only to the extent that they correspond to the expression of some given set of abilities. He wasn't saying that, but he was saying the true realm of freedom lies beyond material production. But let's say take capitalism. You know, many countries have taken sort of free market capitalism and turned that into a form of collective labor, right? State-owned production. But, or you could say that, you know, communism replaced capitalism. But communism never really moved away from the idea that having something was, you know, the first and foremost priority. I mean, communism never moved into the realm of the second negation. You know, negating the sense of having, negating the sense of ownership, whether it was private ownership or state ownership. So what they did was take private ownership and turn it into state ownership, but never really questioned the entire idea of ownership itself. So we've never really seen revolutions move historically from the first negation to the second negation. And so that's a kind of philosophical answer to your question. But there are some promising examples today, and I think one of them is Venezuela. And I think that Venezuela has had a really bad rap in the U.S., in the U.S. media. I'm not so sure what what kind of a rap it's been given in Canada, but I suspect it's fairly similar. But I think it's an interesting place to watch and visit and really get a sense of what's going on and to see what Chavez is attempting to do. I'm not crazy about everything Chavez is doing. Certainly I'm critical of some of his political alliances with Iran, but nonetheless, I think there's some really interesting things happening on the ground.
One of the things that I'm always happy to talk to you about is the sense of clarity as to how, you know, one thing doesn't necessarily exclude another, right? The fact that we're striving for the second negation doesn't blur the complexity of those relationships that exist. So to me, it seems that as we as we imagine and strive to co-create an alternative, we also need to be grounded and realize, you know, that many people are so embedded in maintaining that structure that to uphold that structure takes both the struggle of striving to put something else into place and one of transitioning those people into a new way of seeing the world, a new possibility of being.
Exactly. And I think it's the role of schooling, unfortunately, has been in a sense to police, you know, the limits of the possible. And we have our guardians and sentinels out there that call themselves educators, and they're basically, in a sense, I think, policing our subjectivity or policing our unconscious and setting limits to the possibilities of how we think in ways we can think about new forms of cooperation, new forms of reciprocity, new ways of organizing our economic, political, social, and cultural lives, and how we can do those and have an organic, integrated way of doing that. I think it is possible. Something that really needs to take off in a world historical way. Now, I was hoping that given the horrible, traumatic crisis of capital that people are struggling with all throughout the world, Canada did escape some of the trauma other countries are facing because of its fiscal policies. But nevertheless, you know, everybody's hurting. And, of course, disproportionately, other countries south of the border are hurting much more than anywhere else that you could imagine, and at least on this continent. And I think that with the crisis of capital, we did see with the Occupy movements, we did see some momentum. But any kind of momentum we have has to take on a transnational scope. It's absolutely completely imperative that that happen. It's going to start someplace. It's going to start locally. We saw the Zapatista movement, for instance, in 1994. That started a momentum. Unfortunately, that's become a kind of stalemate. We saw that, you know, the excitement around Chavismo and the Bolivarian Revolution. That seems to be, you know, kind of slowing down in terms of inspiring other people in other communities, in other regions, in other locales and countries. So, you know, unfortunately, it seems that whenever these sparks, whether we call it Arab Spring, or, you know, whether we call it the Occupy Wall Street movement, these movements, they tend to be sort of driven by a kind of inertia, a kind of political inertia, and they always need to be fired up. And sooner or later, when there is an alternative that becomes... See, I really believe this. I believe that we need, and we don't have right now, in some of the eco-pedagogues who are involved in eco-pedagogy, environmental pedagogy, they're helping us do this. They're helping us create this template that will enable us to say, okay, I believe that there is an alternative to vampire capitalism. And it's, you can't have any kind of sustained reform within the capitalist law of value. It's just not going to happen. You know, you can redistribute some of the wealth here and there, and it's like putting, you know, a Band-Aid on a, you know, mortal wound. It's gonna help a little bit. It's going to stem, you know, the pain for a short period of time. But I think we really need to uproot capitalism. And the reason that I think people are reluctant to do it is because there's no real viable alternative. And there has to be that viable alternative in the minds of the people before they just, you know, can jump out and take to the streets. Or otherwise, capital will recolonize their subconsciousness and their subjectivities, and they'll end up exactly where they were before, but with just the same kind of regime, with just a different set of faces. And so I think it's up to us as progressives on the progressive left, the liberal left, and the more radical left to come up with some viable alternatives that we can actually sell to the people and that would be workable. And that's a really difficult task.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much once again for being with us this morning.
My great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Take care.
Cambia lo superficial, cambia también lo profundo.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.